Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. We have a very pertinent conversation today. We're going to be talking about the big 800-pound gorilla that is stopping the Congress and the country from reengineering the federal budget. And I have invited Richard Dolan to join me to talk about that 800-pound gorilla because I consider him the world's leading researcher on the topic. And I know that Salieri Report subscribers are very familiar with Richard and his work, but I want to go through the full introduction today because I think it's very important when we talk about this topic that you understand the extent of his background. Richard is the author of what used to be the two definitive volumes on the UFOs called UFOs and the National Security State. It was a two-volume work, and it's extraordinary. He followed it up with a book called After Disclosure, which was an analysis of what would happen if UFO secrecy really did end. And so the question was, what happens next? And then he published a book which has been for several years in the best books for the next year in our annual wrap-ups, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which to me is the best summary treatment of all aspects of this phenomena. And really gets into the question of who's really governing here and why are we behaving this way. Prior to becoming interested, Richard was headed to be an academic. He studied at the University of Rochester. He studied Cold War strategy, European history, and international diplomacy, and then studied at Alfred University and Oxford University as well. Now he has expanded way beyond UFOs because when you really look at the UFO phenomena and you then get into the governance phenomena and then you get into just about every aspect of what's really going on. And it was Richard who really promoted and coined and defined the theory of a breakaway civilization and has become very knowledgeable in different aspects of new technology, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, how that relates to the phenomena, technology transfer out of the black budget world. Richard has a Richard Dolan Press and publishes books on many related topics, including his own, and also has a radio show. And he has joined me today to talk about this phenomena and how it relates to the politics of the Trump administration dealing with the federal budget, because in many respects, with the end of the debt growth model over, we are now back to having to deal with the fundamentals of the budget. So, Richard, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much. I always love doing interviews with you, every time.
Well, let's. I want to start off with a short history of the black budget since World War II forward and how it relates to an enormous amount of secret spending on the kinds of things that you have been studying. So let's start in 1947. Do you want me to walk through or do you want to walk through?
Well, I'm sure we can do this together. In 1947, a lot of very big things happened that year. All right, both in our officially acknowledged history and in our, let's say, our unacknowledged history. So in our officially acknowledged history, we had the passage of the National Security Act. Very important. It created not simply an independent Air Force, but it created a CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, that had, let's just say, virtually little to no oversight, and really ever since has more or less been able to run amok with the most thinnest veneer of oversight. So there's that, in addition to creating the National Security Council and a lot of other structures that now, to this day, make up our political power system in the United States. Really, it was a revolution. Before 9/11, there was the National Security Act of 1947. At the same time, there was an explosion of UFO sightings, what they were back then calling flying saucer sightings in the United States. This was not the first time the U.S. military had dealt with this phenomenon. They were dealing with it the previous year in 1946 over Europe. They were dealing with it during the Second World War. But in 1947, it became a big thing, and of course, we had the event in Roswell, where it absolutely appears to me and many other researchers that we I say we, the military, recovered technology that we did not manufacture that was highly exotic and, let's say, presumably not from our civilization. What I would just say is this. If there is even one single example of a retrieval of a crashed UFO, then that has been hidden from us for an entire human lifetime. And it would have to be that that technology would be studied at the most deep and profound levels of our military-industrial complex, and that the secrecy of that would take on a life of its own. But in fact, it wasn't simply one example of a crashed retrieval. I think the evidence is strong that there had been multiple retrievals of exotic technology, and I don't know if we want to go into all of that here, but I've written about it, other people have written about it. So you have Roswell, 6 years before that, you had Cape Girardeau in 1941 in Missouri, and after that we had an event in Kingman, Arizona, and we had an event in Aztec, New Mexico in the late 40s. Las Vegas, 1962, was actually a very, very excellent research case, and on through the 60s and 70s. So what we have is an infrastructure that has acquired, developed, and studied exotic technology in secret, away from the rest of us, which has created what I've often called a breakaway civilization, and other people have called it that. And so I think this, there have been a lot of factors in creating what we call the black budget, not simply UFOs, but I have always wanted to point out to people that the UFO phenomenon is a really important foundation of what we might call the black budget culture, black budget society today. So it's part of the discussion, and really an important part of the discussion.
So let me step back and talk about money for a second. Is what we did in 47 and the 47 and the 49 Act is we gave the government the ability to claw money out of all the different agencies' budgets and move it into a non-accountable, non-transparent pot called the black budget.
Yeah, now, exactly.
We also connected that to the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is a fund managed by the New York Fed member banks for the Secretary of Treasury directly, not going through the bureaucracy, which had basically complete freedom to intervene and engage in different activities in the financial markets and the precious metals markets. So you could start rigging markets and trading on inside information.
And this was a new thing in the 40s, you're saying?
Well, the Exchange Stabilization Fund got created in the 30s. But when you combine it with a non-transparent sort of endless availability of money from the black budget, you give them the ability to do a lot more things in a lot greater amounts in the markets.
Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
You now have, you know, you turbocharge what you can do in the Exchange Stabilization Fund. But then you combine that with the seizures of money from the Japanese and the Germans, because many of those seizures were deposited into the Exchange Stabilization Fund. So I always tell the story of the Dulles brothers sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell, and they've moved that money into the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and the Vatican asks them to rig the elections in Europe in 48, and they use that money. And
yeah, one of the greatest slush funds in the world. Wasn't this in, what was that great book on Alan Dulles, which I have a copy of, I read a while ago?
Devil's Chessboard.
That's it, The Devil's Chessboard, a fantastic book.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I think the history of covert operations in America is a history of replenishing that fund to the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Do we have any idea how large that fund might have been at the conclusion of World War II and when Dulles helped set that up?
No, there are various estimates of how much money they seized from both the Japanese and the Germans, and speculation as to, you know, whether it went in the Exchange Stabilization Fund or various other trusts. So there's all sorts of information or disinformation about where it might have gone.
Yeah, okay.
But I think if you look at things like the, you know, in part 9/11 or the asset forfeiture that started in the 80s, a lot of those were designed to replenish those funds. And I also, as you know, I believe that 9/11, part of the goal on 9/11 was to get some of that hidden sources of finance moved on budget because it was getting so dysfunctional. The amount of money. So,
yeah.
So let's take the black budget plus this hidden system of finance plus the market manipulations and sort of covert ops like opening the United States up to drugs. All of those monies, let's just call them the black monies, that funding has grown and grown and grown, particularly as financial fraud became very effective and sophisticated. And I want to get in, we'll hit the 1980s and we'll get into that. But as that amount of money has grown, it has become enough to finance a national security infrastructure, which is basically a parallel world. And most people don't see because they don't, that money doesn't run through the official U.S. budget. You know, we have a parallel budget, which is invisible, non-transparent. And as you said, you know, the CIA has literally become the world's largest banker on an out-of-control basis.
What's amazing to me, when we really step back and look at this, so official estimates of the black budget, if you go to, like, I think Wired magazine did an estimate some years ago, and New York Times, I mean, these are not very useful to me, but I often hear the number $50 billion being tossed about as the official black budget. So that would mean our tax dollars that are classified and go into this aspect of the Pentagon's budget. So that's black. So $50 billion would actually qualify. That would be within the top 10, possibly top 5 military spendings in the world. So in other words...
But that's nothing compared to...
Exactly. That's
right.
The thing. So, that is nothing compared with what is actually... So the official black budget of the U.S. would qualify that as one of the strongest militaries in the world. And then when you take what is, in fact, the real black budget, who knows how big that is?
Let me do some numbers just to give you some sense. So let's say the black budget is $50 billion. Let's say the hidden system of finance and what you can do with financial fraud in the markets will give you another $50 to $500 billion, depending on the year. It's volatile. And then last year alone, then since 1998, you've had what I call the missing money, which is now up to over $11 trillion in undocumentable adjustments at HUD and DOD. So last year, we had $6.5 trillion go missing from or undocumentable adjustments at DOD. Now that's, you know, that's 500% of the existing budget.
Exactly.
And people say to me,
how
well, you can't steal six government securities fraud. It is absolutely possible. And it's not a discussion for today, but what I will tell you is with government securities, it is absolutely possible to steal $6.5 trillion in 1 year. No problem. And I can, you know, at another time...
What is the global GDP? I don't even know what that is. It's got to be not much more than that.
I'd have to look it
up. Global GDP has got to be,
right.
I mean, I'm thinking less than $10 trillion a year. I don't want to get too far off, but I'm wondering what you think. Remember, of course, Rumsfeld famously talking about his $2.6 and $2.3 trillion of missing money, we'll just say, and the $2.3 trillion was stated on September 10th, 2001. You have talked about this at length. Many of us have discussed it. I recall if someone goes to the wiki site, Wikipedia, they look this up, they will see. This is, to me, astonishing that Wikipedia... Of course, all they do is astroturf everything these days. But a fellow named Dov Zakheim, I'm sure you know, was in charge of overseeing the resolution of all of that missing money. And what anyone will read in the Wikipedia entry on this was that they actually got the number down to zero in like the next couple of years. And I'm just saying, are you guys kidding me? Like they got it down to half a trillion. Like within, I don't know, later in 2002, I think, and eventually got it down to zero by resolving the discrepancies. And this is just the most non-credible thing, but they just
right.
Bought
it's
that
a completely,
out.
It's a completely non-credible situation. So, well, before we jump up to 2001, let me jump back.
Sure.
And say, if you look at So we're talking about a very significant amount of money. And if we just say, where did the money go? You've done a wonderful Salieri report on underground bases. Underground, but if you look at the underground infrastructure that the U.S. or the U.S. military is responsible for, both building and maintaining, it's clearly very significant.
Agreed. Right. We have the work of Dr. Richard Sauter. He's, just for starters, detailing the plans, the technology, and certainly the money was well within the means of the U.S. military complex since the end of World War II to build deep, sophisticated underground facilities, almost labyrinthian, we might even say.
Right. So, in fact, the reason our infrastructure has deteriorated for the last 30 or 40 years, it really hasn't. You're not looking at it, and you don't use it. We've made fantastic investments in infrastructure. The second thing is we clearly have, NASA as a percent of the federal budget has declined. But I think what happened was a lot of the space program just went dark. And so we have plenty of space activities. They're just not on the official budget. So clearly we have some kind of secret space program going on. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, yes. The evidence for this, I think, is very, very strong. In terms of genuine leaks going back decades, from whistleblowers whose identities are totally confirmable and who really speak with some knowledge of this, as well as evidence of space-based anomalies that have been recorded actually for many decades. Some of these are extremely well documented. So there's clearly activity going on in Earth orbit and beyond that is not supposed to be going on. If that activity is not 100% ours, if it belongs to someone else, that would still, in my view, be evidence for a secret space program because you would have to have the ability to deal with, to investigate that activity out there in a way that the rest of the world wouldn't be noticing. So you would have to do that covertly. And then, of course, I think there's a strong case to be made that some of that technology out there is, in fact, ours. Now, there have been a number of, good whistleblowers and good pieces of video evidence. Not all of it's great, but some of it is, I think, very, very good, and some of it's on YouTube that indicates some things going on in Earth orbit that are not supposed to be there.
Right. I want to stay pre-1980 for a second. So what we have is this national infrastructure and parallel operation growing. And if you look at the amount of money, whether it's the black budget, the hidden system of financial fraud, the amount of money that's being plowed in is also growing, and the establishment is grappling with how to keep raising all of this money. Now, I just want to mention one of my favorite stories. When Eisenhower created Area 51, because a lot of the early activities got organized around Area 51. When he created Area 51, he issued an executive order that put CIA in charge of security, which turned out to include financing for Area 51. And there's a wonderful story that you had a whistleblower do an interview when he was sort of sick. Maybe if you could tell the story about Eisenhower back then trying to get the CIA to respect line management in the federal government.
Yes, gladly, I will. This is an interview I'd done. It's very available on YouTube, where I interviewed a gentleman. This was in early 2013. He's since deceased. He actually wasn't a CIA person. He was with Army Signal Intelligence, but he was contracted as a young man by the CIA. He had a supervisor who was a CIA station officer, he said. And they were charged. This guy, before he did his Area 51 trip, had been involved in receiving and looking over photographs of UFOs that were sent in from Europe. And he talked a little bit about that in the interview. But as a young man, he accompanied his supervising officer at the request of President Eisenhower, this is in the late 50s, to go to Area 51 or south of Area 51. Because Eisenhower, according to him, had not been satisfied with getting the information he wanted to about the ET-related program that was there, and was so stonewalled and frustrated, he said, by the military and by the intelligence community that was running it, that he, according to this man who was speaking to me, who was deathly ill at the time, that Eisenhower was considering actually invading Area 51 with the military to take it over and to regain control over it. They went. They had a kind of a meeting that sounded very much like what like Bob Lazar would talk about later. That is, a program to reverse engineer alien craft. This man also described an alien being that was there that communicated telepathically. A number of other things that really, my take on this man is that he was truthful to me. I do think he was on pain-killing meds at the time, and his memory was foggy, and this has to be said. He couldn't remember the name of people like J. Edgar Hoover, for example. But I think he was truthful. His son-in-law, this is something that a lot of people aren't aware, his son-in-law was present during that interview, and I got to know the son-in-law fairly well. These were good people, in my opinion. The son-in-law knew his father-in-law's story very, very well. Had heard it for years. And this story was very consistent with what the son-in-law had known privately through this man for a long time. So I believe them. The big takeaway is that essentially Eisenhower had felt he was losing control over the black budget program.
Right.
Which, by the way, is very much in line with what we know officially about Eisenhower and America's nuclear program. This is an absolute fact that in 1959, 1960, at the end of his presidency, he had tried for several years to get an audience with the head of Strategic Air Command, a general named Thomas Power, who succeeded Curtis LeMay, and wanted to know what was our plan if there was a nuclear war. I mean, it's a simple question, and here's the president of the U.S., five-star general Eisenhower, unable until October of 1960 to get an audience with the head of Strategic Air Command, and what he learned then shocked him and terrified him. Basically, he learned that we were going to incinerate the entire northern hemisphere of the Soviet Union. It was just going to be gone.
Right.
So you have these moments where Ike really had lost control, and I think the Area 51 story is very much in line with this.
Right. I don't know if you've ever seen the one of the best documentaries, I think, to help people understand. I'm calling these days what's going on in Washington the Swamp Strikes Back. There is a documentary called Satellite Fever, where the military-industrial complex, after they put up Sputnik, turns on the shriek-o-meter to insist that they have to give what became NASA to the military, and dramatically increase defense spending. And it's all, you can see, it's all engineered to try and bully Ike, and he won't be bullied. And his management of the whole thing is quite amazing. I mean, he was...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you really want to watch Satellite Fever, because it is one of the great examples of a president standing up and standing down the military-industrial complex. But, and if you watch it, you understand the power of his speech saying, we need to beware, because he saw very early on that this whole infrastructure that we're talking about was running out of control. Now, there's one other thing I want to mention, and that is we have Corso writing about the transfer a lot of this technology. Of course, Area 51 is in California. A lot of this technology getting transferred out into essentially Silicon Valley. And it's very interesting. If you go out to Silicon Valley...
It's in Nevada, but close to the California desert, I guess we could...
Right.
Where...
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And that did get transferred out there, according to Corso's testimony.
So it's always funny, because I've spent a lot of time looking at the narcotics trafficking out in the West, including the Dark Alliance allegations. So you have the technology being transferred into Silicon Valley, and then you're destroying minority neighborhoods up and down California to pour cheap capital in. And you go out to Silicon Valley, and these guys tell you that they're totally private market. They have nothing to do with government, and this is something they've created themselves. You're looking at them.
For sure.
Oh, my God.
They would love us to believe.
Well, but I don't, Richard, I really don't think they know. I really...
No, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you are right.
Right.
Why would they know? Right. I would just point out, you mentioned Dark Alliance. That's a reference to Gary Webb, the great journalist who died of not one but two allegedly self-inflicted gunshot wounds at the head in 2004 after he exposed the narco-trafficking overseen by CIA with the,
right.
You know, the South American drug traffickers and so on. But there was another journalist who also was suicided a little earlier than Gary Webb, and that was Danny Castellaro,
right.
Who wrote about something he called the octopus because of the many tentacles. And in fact, as I recall, I did read his book a while ago, he talked about a lot about California and
right.
the narco trafficking between CIA and actually a number of the Indian reservations that were out there, one in particular,
right.
I know, but also dealing with Silicon Valley. And also, before Castellaro died in a hotel room in 1991, I think, he was looking into UFO links and things like MJ-12 and so on, right before he was clearly murdered.
And he was looking into Promise Software, because Promise Software...
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk 1980 on is when the financial fraud exploded, and part of what helped that be accomplished was Promise Software and different software technologies that made it possible to expand this enormous bifurcation between literally a parallel civilization. How do you finance and build a parallel civilization in the trillions of dollars without the first civilization noticing? So
yeah, it's like having a massive leech bloodsucker sucking off
right.
of the official civilization, and you got to do it in such a way that the
they don't notice.
You know, the great body is not aware of it being drained off, and
right.
that's what's been going on.
One of the things I dealt with was cleaning up financial fraud done during Iran-Contra. And when you talk to the folks who did that fraud, it was in the 80s. And so we go back and you take the 47 and 49 Act. But then when Bush came in 81, Bush was given control as vice president over enforcement and intelligence in the National Security Council, essentially. That was his team. And they got Reagan to do an executive order that said all that money could be used for corporate contracts and corporations could do classified stuff. So now you've got publicly traded stocks who can suck up an unending infinite amount of publicly traded money. Yeah, that's why whenever the mining stocks go up a lot.
Piece.
Yeah. Very important because remember when Bush II went into office, he created a national security waiver so that publicly traded companies could defy SEC law in their reporting and that of things they did for the national security budget.
Right.
So
I didn't realize that this was an innovation of the early 80s.
Yeah, it was 80. It was one of the first things Bush did. So now what you can do
if I could just,
I just
want to make sure that I'm following you. I know you're on a roll. But what you're saying is that these major defense contracting corporations, these intelligence community corporations, run for profit, making major money through tax dollars, doing classified work,
right.
were allowed to skirt critical FCC regulations that would, you know, were designed to protect the public against financial fraud and things like this. That's sort of
right.
what you're saying.
So they can.
That was
they
starting
can
early
start,
1980s.
What 81 did was it said they can do all this classified stuff, you know, paid for with essentially, you know, government money. So now publicly traded corporations can do all these private functions, you know, and tap into all this money. So that's number one. But then, now, they could skirt a lot of SEC because the really tough SEC regulations didn't go in until, you know, it came in later after the Iran Contra-Fraud broke. So in 89, and then with Dodd-Frank, you had all these changes in the law that toughened it up. And so what you needed to do, then Bush, too, created the National Security Waiver that says, okay, the National Security Advisor can, in essence, waive SEC rules and laws related to...
Got it.
Okay, so now what has evolved is a situation where private corporations can generate profit on this entire black and parallel civilization and report it in the publicly traded markets in a way that is completely fraudulent to SEC law and disclosure.
And they do it technically, legally, because
yes.
A wave of the hand just says they can do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So, so if you go back to 1980 and you talk to people who did the financial fraud, what they will tell you is, oh my God, we did this one thing and we got away with it. And we said, well, let's try this. And, you know, they couldn't believe they kept getting away with it. And it was working and they were making much more money than they expected. And then it just exploded. Now, why did it explode? I have a theory on why it explodes. If you read Norm Berglund's book, Rings of Saturn, and
yes.
you look at when the Voyager went by Saturn and basically saw, you know, what he describes as huge plasma spaceships docked in the rings of Saturn as if they were sucking up energy from them.
Yes.
I think what happened was, you know, those pictures came back from Voyager and that whole infrastructure said, you know, it did the alpha male, oh my God, get as much money as possible. You know, we have to be prepared to deal with, you know, whatever. And at that point, the only thing that was important was getting as much money as possible to do whatever you thought you were going to do to deal with us.
That is a fascinating hypothesis. So the rings of Saturn, yeah, that's Bergstrom, I think was his name. The photographs that he showed from, that's all from the Voyager missions, that's all from our satellite, they are remarkable indeed. And they show, I don't know how conventional astronomers and scientists explain some of those structures. I don't know what they're official, but there are things that look very much, they look like they could be artificial, I suppose.
Right.
And so, right, that would get the attention at that time, and you'd want to have a response. You would need
to
have
and
a response.
And so I think if you look at a lot of the Iran-Contra financial fraud, if you look at the different patterns of fraud, it was mostly real estate. And if you look at the models they used to do the fraud, they literally came back in the 90s and took those models. Yes, they did real estate, but they added the equity and financial, not just the asset-backed securities market, but then the equity markets, and then they turbo-juiced it with derivatives. And
gotcha.
And that's when the financial fraud, I mean, it was quite something in the 80s, but in the 90s, it went global. And of course, with globalization is the big, you know, globalization gave you the activity and the flow to massively bubble the global housing markets, but particularly in the United States and Europe and in the developed world, and suck out. That's when the financial coup happened. And I, you know, one of my theories on the coup, we talked about the cost of underground bases or secret space program, but that's when I think they said, look, you know, we can't keep doing this. Let's pull all the money out and create the equivalent of an endowment that can produce enough interest and dividends to run the global governments on a private endowed basis from here on out, because that's the only way we can keep this secret.
So the point of the housing bubble was to generate the income for them. And then, of course, I assume when they decided to pop the bubble, to crash it, they found a way to make, you know, an enormous amount of money on top of that as well. So it's win-win for them. I think that's what you're saying.
Well, right. My guess is from 1996 on, they moved out approximately $40 to $50 trillion. And if you earn 5% interest on $40 to $50 trillion a year, that's $2.5 trillion a year, and that's enough to run the U.S. government from an endowment.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So now, was it? Now, there are other things, but if you look at the infrastructure, underground bases, secret space program, and now add to that geoengineering and weather control, because they're terraforming the whole planet, you're talking about a very, very expensive infrastructure. Now, coming into 2001, I want to go to 9/11,
mm-hmm.
The money had started to go missing in fiscal 1998, so we saw big missing money. And I was very focused on it because of what it meant to the average taxpayer. I mean, basically, you were moving 100% or more of our retirement savings. You were basically stealing it in a way that we wouldn't notice until it was too late.
Exactly.
And so I was trying to bring people, you know, basically you're saying, okay, for, you know, we can pay for nursing homes or space programs. We'd rather use the money for space. Let's get all the money out before they realize it's gone. So I was trying to get people to be focused on the missing money, and I was working with a wonderful reporter in Washington who got a hold of this, and I started to do the research to help her write stories. And finally, we persuaded her editor to come up with a huge cover story in Insight magazine, and Insight was distributed to all the congressional offices automatically. So it was always a big impact within the Congress. A huge layout on the missing money and how much had gone missing and what it meant in terms of per household, depending on what state you lived in. And I mean, it was an amazing piece with a big cover story and everything. And I remember saying to her on the weekend, it was going to come out. It was going to come out September 17th, 2001.
Yeah, 2001,
and
exactly.
I remember the week before, it was September 10th, when Rumsfeld came out, and we assumed he did the press conference on the $2.3 trillion missing because he was trying to do a modified hangout to stop our story. In other words, he knew that Insight was coming out with it was going to be $3.3 trillion because the year before they were missing $1.1 trillion.
Well,
so
it is
really
true
that right.
Rumsfeld made a statement in July of 2001 for the House Armed Services Committee where he,
right.
to my knowledge anyway, that was his first statement. And at that point he made it was $2.6 trillion. And the transcript, you know, anyone could read it. And then on September 10th he made a second statement in which he mentioned it was $2.3 trillion. I don't know how they changed $300 billion in the space of 2 months. I don't know how they did that. But
well, when
he did make a statement
in
late July.
What I said to Kelly, the reporter, when he did that was, because we assumed he was trying to get ahead of the Insight magazine story, because it was going to hit desks, a 9/17 story was going to hit desks on the 14th, Friday the 14th, it would have hit the Senate desk. And then,
yep.
So I said to Kelly, I made the mistake of saying nothing will stop this now. And of course, the next day was 9/11.
Boom. Everything stopped it. Yeah.
Boom.
Exactly.
Right. And if you look at 9/11, it destroyed massive records on both government securities fraud and a variety of different FBI and SEC investigations. So, you know, it was very much, I think, one of many agendas in 9/11 was covering up the trail on the, and we know the Office of Naval Intelligence that was researching the missing money got blown up.
That's right.
So 9/11 did a lot to take us into this next step of continuing the parallel, you know, civilization and the funding thereof. And now, from 9/11 on, what we've seen are two things. A massive explosion of money spent on foreign wars and
yes.
a massive explosion of, you know, so many of companies in America just saying, well, let's get on board the you know, the pork train here. And
the gravy train, exactly.
Right, right.
Well, 9/11 now, made it all official. I often describe it as like a debutante coming out party, you know, when she's holding up and she comes out and she's... So the 9/11 was the coming out party of the national security state. I mean, this is something that had developed on a kind of a quiet, sort of unofficial basis since World War II. Truman talked
right.
about it, Eisenhower talked about it, and we all knew it. But then with 9/11, the laws became adjusted, essentially giving us a formal version of neo-fascism, like out in the open. And so with that, with a new legal structure, with the USA Patriot Act and everything that followed on, the foreign wars, the $6.5 trillion, I believe, officially, that we have spent on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq since 01, it gives much greater opportunity for thievery, much greater opportunity than before, I would think, of being able to siphon money out of the public realm into these black programs. I mean, right. I'm sure you would agree.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's like raising
so now
the speed
we
limit.
Have...
You raise it to 65, you can go to 75 or whatever, and
right.
you can steal a little bit more.
So if we divide the GNP into overt and covert, the covert, you know, is getting bigger and bigger. It's busted out and changed the laws so that it can be bigger in the overworld because it's getting so big. But what also happens is, let's turn now to media. Media
sure.
is trying to come up with a way of explaining reality that keeps all of this secret. So,
exactly.
for example, we need a war on terrorism, even though we really are struggling to find a terrorist.
Well, and of course, as anyone who's done the most modest amount of research into the matter can see plain as day, is that the United States explicitly, intentionally has, in fact, created jihadist terrorists for
right.
the last 50 years. I mean, from Muslim Brotherhood in the 60s and 50s, through the Mujahideen and people like John Negroponte in Iraq in 04, 05, creating Islamic Sunni and Shiite terrorists there, right up to Islamic State under Obama. So, yes, we've created
right, well,
them. We use them to justify all of this nonsensical, ruinous spending and destruction.
Right. So, for example, let's go back to the bailouts. So we spent $27 trillion moving all the fraudulent securities and derivatives onto the government balance sheet, essentially.
Is that much? My God. That's breathtaking.
Well, it depends on how you count it. But,
okay.
yeah, my guess is it was about $27 trillion. Now, they say they lent it and paid it back, and there's all sorts of other things. But it's some fantastic amount. It's certainly, my guess is it's at least the amount of outstanding debt we have. You know, so if we have $20 trillion of outstanding debt on the books, my guess is more than that. But basically, to do the financial coup, they issued lots of financial fraudulent securities, and then they recapitalized a lot of that back into the, you know, into the taxpayer one way or the other. So you end up with this fantastic amount of money on the balance sheet now. What's been going on since 1980? What's been going on since 1980 is what's called the great bond bull market. So interest rates were high in 1980. They've been coming down ever since. And everybody's wanted to be in bonds. Everybody's made money in bonds. It was very easy for all the governments around the world to grow their debt. And the ultimate growth in the debt was coming into the bailouts. We recapitalize all the securities fraud, move it on to government balance sheets around the world, but now we're reaching sort of total capacity. And my great quote from last year that I kept using again and again was the German finance minister saying at the G20 meeting in China, the debt growth model is over. There are no reforms that aren't real reforms now. What he was saying is the way we've dealt with the inability to reconcile the conflict between sucking all the money out of the civilization and the needs of the civilization is to just issue more debt or more currency and paper. But that game is over. You know, so when the civilization is being harvested and screams, we solve it by printing more debt. But what he's saying is that game is over, so now we have to deal with reality. We can't paper it over. That's the question. That's why you and I are having the... Because I don't know of a way to deal with it without the truth. So if you look at... Let's go
what
into
about,
the over...
What about a simple situation? I mean, I realize... I think of the example of Iceland, and you could speak to this way better than I did. Iceland's a tiny little country. I think they have 300,000 population. But they, I mean, am I wrong in thinking that they just said, we're not going to pay this, and we're going to imprison some of you bankers, and the hell with all of you. So they did that, and they seem to have gotten out of their hole. Why wouldn't individual nations, Greece, Italy, the United States, do the same thing and just say, we renounce this debt to private, for-profit bankers, and we simply are saying, no, we're not going to, we're wiping the slate clean. I mean, it's a radical thing, but why couldn't a nation simply do that?
So here's let's keep it simple. Let's pretend that America is one neighborhood, and what we're doing is we're financing a parallel neighborhood in the breakaway civilization. You know, we'll just call it the breakaways. So we have one neighborhood and we're financing another neighborhood. Now the problem we have is that our GNP is shrinking because the activities we're using to finance the other neighborhood have to be done on a secret or illegal basis. So we're financing it with narcotics trafficking that create a lot of economic activity, but they ultimately shrink the value of your land, your homes, your businesses, business. Right. So you're in a liquidation mode. Okay, now, what's interesting is if you look at how this neighborhood's economy has been run, it's been run to centralize control and siphon off secret money. Now, if you said to that neighborhood, look, let's just optimize the economy so that we make the GNP as big as possible, and we do it in a way that, the people who create the most GNP make the most money, so there's a really, but everybody's... it's organized to maximize and optimize productivity, whether it's human productivity or labor productivity, and you pay a tax to support, Monsters, Inc. over here. I don't know if you've seen the cartoon movie Monsters, Inc., but, so they have a utility and they get energy by terrorizing us. So we're going to pay Monsters, Inc. a tax. Everyone would be better off. But you can't do that system without transparency. And not only that, if you look at who's going to govern that system, it's going to be somebody other than who governs it now. Because what you've done to maintain the centralization and the secrecy is you've created a system of privilege. And the people, privilege is phenomenally expensive. Because you create a very expensive infrastructure of people who are draining value, not adding value.
Well, I'm wondering, we have really gone very, very far and deep into this conversation, and I know we have not even gotten to Donald Trump and his possible direction that he may be going, and I'm not trying to position myself here for a second part of the interview, but... Let me just say, I would be totally up for it with you, so we could continue this. I don't know if you wanted to segue to that or not, because it just seems to me...
So, let me do one thing, and then we'll segue to that. And we should definitely do a second part, wherever we end up today. But let me tell you what I would do if I was dedicated to maintaining the secrecy, dedicated to maintaining the privilege I had created around the secrecy, and to keep money coming, because I have a big problem if I'm running this. So I'm Mr. Global, I'm running this multiple personality disorder system, and my problem is deflation. Because when you automate with new technology, you deflate the economy.
Because you're making everything cheaper, right? You're making services cheaper. I get it.
And I'm making it cheaper for everybody to do everything for themselves instead of,
Think about 3D printing, advanced 3D printing. Right. I mean, that revolution is happening, and it's going to be accelerating over the next generation. And then 3D printing plus energy paradigms. I keep thinking there's some very, very smart, many smart people in this world who are developing energy breakthroughs that at some point some person is going to upload the design of that, a CAD design, to the next generation Pirate Bay, and we're going to have access to some really cheap energy.
Right. No, it's definitely happening. The price of energy is going to keep coming down, 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 down.
Right.
So here's my problem. I needed inflation to cover up and hide all this money I was stealing. So not only do I run out of problems with the end of the debt growth model, but I'm facing deflation in massive amounts, which means I really need a lot of mind control and control and surveillance systems. And, you know, now I really want to chip everybody so I can keep control, because I'm looking at this and saying, I don't know how to control. So what would I do if I was Mr. Global? Well, I'll tell you what I would do. I would start a process to have a constitutional convention and amendment so that I could change the Constitution. And when I'm through, you know, there are no property rights. I can chip everybody. And whatever they can do, they can't use the Constitution to come in force and get the $50 trillion back.
They go full on Orwell, nonsense, right. Like just right on through.
Yeah. Double down on Orwell. And you see, you've got one group that's pushing that way. They're trying to do a double down on Orwell. And that's why, because they don't see another option. Okay? And that's why it's so important that we all see another option. Because I don't think,
right.
You know, I don't intend to live in double down Orwell.
No. And by the way, I'll just say, like, I really appreciate your sophisticated financial analysis of this. It really does supplement. I've been looking at the same thing. I've seen the same conclusions without the sophistication in the finance that you bring to this. But what I do see is a future. I'm looking at essentially a transhumanist future where those who can afford it can afford better genetic progeny and better
right.
offspring, smarter, stronger, where in addition, you know, they will be making use of breakaway technology that they clearly are not going to want to share with the rest of the world in terms of energy, in terms of communication, because by giving up some of those technologies, they're giving power to the rest of us, and that threatens their status. So their decision
right.
is to go on a full 24/7 police state world, a kind
right.
of a new fascism, a sexy fascism as well, where people are, you know, happily mind-controlled. You have to control mainstream
right.
media for that. You have to control the academic community. You have to control the political class. All of that. And they're doing it. I mean, we can see
and
them doing that.
Yeah. And here's the problem with it. The problem is when you live in a bell jar, I always say people who live in a rigged system get stupid. And what they're missing is they're missing the benefit of the group intelligence. And, you know, one of the things that frightens me the most when I'm on the East Coast or the West Coast dealing with sort of groups from that category, so Hollywood, Silicon Valley, New York, D.C., is they are completely missing so much of the knowledge and wisdom in the group intelligence, and they don't realize it and they don't know it. So,
They're the intellectual class, let's just say, or they're the highly successful professional class, but what they are not understanding is that there is absolutely a control system designed specifically for them. You get to a certain
right.
level of accomplishment in this society. There's an education system designed for you. There's an economy designed for you, and all of it is designed explicitly to keep you intellectually sedated and
right.
and off your game.
They have no idea how they're being used. And
right.
I'll tell you, Richard, the hardest thing to do is look in the mirror and say, I'm the patsy. I know, because I had to do it. And it was either do that or not stay alive. Because I needed, you know, I needed to figure out what was really going on. And the only way I was going to face that was to face the fact I was the patsy. So, you know,
it's
I was
hard.
Used to being a member
yeah.
in good standing of the predator class.
I had a similar feeling. I wasn't
yeah.
at the your level in government service and so on, but I was on my path to becoming part of that system. And I took great pride in being ahead of the curve and knowing more than I thought other people knew, and not recognizing until I was a very mature adult that I was part of a control system, and I had no idea.
Right.
And it's a difficult thing to come to terms with, because especially for those people who are intelligent, well-educated, they don't want to come to the conclusion that that there's this important piece of reality that they've been missing. Absolutely, right. They don't want to do that.
There's another thing that I've mentioned before in this Slater Report, so I'll just say it quickly. When I was, one of our great innovations in the 90s was we took the optimization technology that AT&T Bell Laboratories invented for routing telephone calls and applied it to mortgage securities, and it completely cracked the market because we were able to get the real estate market, the mortgage market, and the securities market to bid head-on-head against each other by being able to deal with the complexity through the software. And in the process, I got to study how AT&T Bell Laboratories had applied it to the routing of airlines crew scheduling. And they, for many years, had kept the data and were able to price out the cost of a rule. So they could tell the airline companies a cost of a federal regulation or a union rule, how much it had sub-optimized the solutions, both for the pilots and the crews and the company. And one of the things they discovered was that seniority for pilots so sub-optimized the whole optimization that the pilots themselves were worse off for the seniority.
When you say sub-optimized, is that another word for saying just degraded? I'm not really sure I'm following.
Yeah, so let's say you, with an optimization on a crew scheduling, you can give 80% of the people everything they want. But you add a new rule and suddenly you can only give 60% of the people everything they want. And on and on and on. It may relate to money, it may relate to time, or other preferences. But you're talking about how big can we make the pie? And in other words, the pie shrunk so much from the constraints of the privilege that even the privileged guys got less because they wanted privilege. And so their solution was less than what they wanted as a result of them demanding privilege. It harmed the pie so much. Slice of the pie. You know, so they insisted, we must have 25% of the pie, but the pie was so shrunk that their 25% was less than if they'd said, you know, something, we'll take 20%.
Honestly, Catherine, I will tell you, I've just recently been reading the works of Friedrich Hayek, the great economist of the 20th century, and I'm really turned on by this guy. One of the things that he pointed out is that, you know, to have a functioning economy, it is so unbelievably complex. Like, I think he pointed out to me, I'd never really thought to read something as simple as a book, an old-fashioned book with pen and ink. What are the things that go into making a book? What goes into making ink? Well, my God, thousands and thousands and maybe millions of interactions to create the kind of ink that we need to go on, and the same with paper. So, in other words, it's of a level of complexity that it is impossible, literally impossible, for a command economy to manage. So what you have to do for a functioning economy, you really need to maximize freedom for the people to be able to create the goods and services on an individual basis based on profit and return, because there's no other way you're going to get it to happen. And so what I think you're saying here is that this breakaway privileged economic elite has done is they are creating more and more command structures into the economy, where formerly, you know, they're using the freedom of the economy to make their money, but they're imposing so much of their own will and distorting that economy so much that they are inhibiting the creation of wealth and thereby, in the long run, inhibiting their own creation of wealth.
I will tell you that the existing wealth is 1% of what it could be if we were free to optimize.
Wow, yes. And, you know, I think you're probably right, because we're in such a highly, even someone who doesn't look at the covert aspects to our world, you look at the utter bureaucratization and the stifling of initiative that is going on. And it has to be true that our capability to create a truly great civilization is so much greater than it is than what we're doing.
Right.
Because we have really creating this command type of economy.
They're trying to use digital technology software and, you know, total surveillance combined with artificial intelligence to try and get the kind of optimization you could with markets. It's never going to work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's never ever going to work. Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm sure
so
if
let's
they have access to AI, they'll make their money, but it won't be what it could be.
Right. So let's go to Trump's budget. So we come into the budget. Now, here's what's interesting about the Trump campaign and first 30 days is yeah. Trump has a habit of busting through, you know, there's an official reality, and he has a way of punching holes in it. So,
yes, indeed.
On vaccines, on Common Core, on, you
yes,
know,
yes.
he keeps punching holes, and he has to be careful.
On 9/11.
On 9/11.
He kind of inched his way toward that.
Right, he
on
punched
ISIS,
a hole. Right, definitely on ISIS, he's punched a big hole. So he keeps punching holes, and what it's getting America to, you know, to the point of saying is, you know, okay, we can leave the official reality. So now they're starting to talk about different aspects of the official reality. I don't know if you saw, but Robert De Niro just did an interview with Cheryl Atkinson, where he said, "Look,
oh,
I love both.
She's amazing."
Right. Yeah, they're both amazing. And he said, look, the science is not clear. Now, that man, in my opinion, risked his life. And he knew. If you looked at his face, he knew he was risking his life by doing it. But mm-hmm. but I don't think that interview would ever have happened if Trump hadn't started it. Anyway, but you're seeing that in all these different areas. And people are getting so much energy from being free to talk about whatever it is they want to. You know, it might be Common Core. It might be, it's many
absolutely.
Different topics.
Absolutely.
And they're getting so much energy from it. I don't see how you just can't kill everybody. So, I think the conversation has begun. Now, that brings us back to the budget, because all the different issues that Congress is fighting about come back to the budget. In Washington, reality is decided by what happens to the budget. Now, last week we just saw the budget director finally confirmed. And the Treasury Secretary. So now there's no excuse not to deal with the budget. And so here's the question, Richard. We have this growing, you know, national security state. We have a president who's punching holes in the official reality. How
yes,
are we going to deal with it? We have a group pushing for a constitutional convention because they don't want to give back the money they stole, and they certainly don't want, you know, the general population. They don't want the deplorables having, you know, stock certificates in the UFO hardware.
What a way to put it.
You know, those UFOs, we own them. We paid for them. We own them. And if you assert a common law right of offset and say we want the, you know, the ownership rights to those assets, then we own those UFOs flying around.
Mm-hmm. So, well, the question is, where will all of this lead? I mean, we're 1 month into this new presidency, and we're seeing a full scale covert, not so covert war that's breaking out in the elite. I mean, it's almost like what you saw with ancient Rome with Caesar.
Right.
I'll just point out, you know, it was a great interest of mine studying ancient Roman history. And Caesar came into power. He was a populist, full on. He was a member of the aristocracy. But he was a populist. He believed in either, making the people believe they had power or actually giving them a little bit more power, depending on how you interpret it. But he was definitely the darling of the masses. They loved him, which was why the Roman Senate hated him, which is why the Roman Senate declared war against him when he was coming back from Gaul. We look at Caesar, sometimes people say, oh, he was a dictator, despot. In reality, he was fighting for his survival against an utterly corrupt Senate that was
right.
only interested in maintaining its grip on power. That's the reality, and Caesar ended up winning that civil war, and then they killed him. So ruling elites throughout history have had these divisions, these disagreements that have sometimes erupted into civil war. I firmly believe we're seeing that right now in American
right.
history. We're at that point where Trump has that same position as Caesar. and whether you're pro Caesar or against Caesar will affect your position on Trump, I suppose.
Right. Well, I would say there are two factions in the establishment. One that wants to rebuild North America at the cost of the empire, and the other, basically Hollywood, Silicon Valley, Washington, and D.C., you know, who want to keep empire going at any cost. Now, if you look at the four centers of those keep the empire going, they all deal with invisible assets, not concrete assets. You know, so they deal with
Hollywood.
They deal with
Silicon Valley.
They deal with financial assets. You know, it's all stuff you can do on a computer. Everybody who does concrete stuff knows you can't keep the empire going. You know, because they got to fight the wars, they got to grow the food, they got to dig the energy out of the ground. The people who know the concrete stuff, who are doing the concrete stuff and understand the concrete stuff and make the concrete go, know it's over. That's over. That's not going to work. And we're not going to go out and commit suicide for you for four more years pretending to keep it going because it's over.
That's a really good way to put it.
Right. So it's really the concrete guys against the intellectual capital guys. Anyway, I think you have those two factions. Now, the problem you have in reengineering the budget is you've got a whole bunch of people in Washington, both in Congress or in the bureaucracy, who have control files. And the people who hold those control files work for the other team. I mean,
Trump team now, or is that what you're saying?
Let's take a senator called, we'll just call him, you know, Bill. Senator Bill. Mm-hmm. Senator Bill has a control file that the Mossad has and the CIA has.
Yeah.
And they got Bill with dirty pictures, you know, having sex with 8-year-old boys.
Exactly. Okay. Right.
And, you know, Bill's wife did a dirty deal. They've got that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, for the last 10 years, Bill has done a whole bunch of things, you know, that he doesn't want his family to know, let alone, you know, his constituents to know.
Exactly.
And Bill's gone along, and he feels bad about it, and he doesn't see, you know, and if you try and corner him on this, you just remind him how bad he feels about the whole thing, and he wants to feel good about himself. You know, he wants to go to the latest rally and have everybody clap for him. You know, So, the new administration comes along and says, you know, we're going to stop all this stuff. And meantime, he's got to do what he's told. And the last thing he wants is something happen that's going to out all of this stuff.
Yeah, he's got a major exposure problem. Him and much of the establishment has this problem.
Right. And to win his next election, he's got to raise a whole bunch of money. And the only way he can raise money is if the companies who fund him, you know, get more capital gains out of whatever happens in the budget. So, his constituents want their stocks to go up, and so he's got to do something that, whether it's lower their taxes or increases their revenue, makes their stock go up, or he's out.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So, why is he going to embrace making America great again? He just wants to make his constituents' stock go up.
No, and we can see this. The entire political establishment, both political parties, are, absolutely, you know, hostile right up until, with all their strength to everything that the current president is doing and proposing. I don't think they'll ever have a situation where they are not hostile. So this is definitely a civil war. And the only question is, it's a civil war that's taking place within the establishment, and it is having a spillover into the population, because you've had a media, which is part of this, they've demonized Trump to make him look like Satan 2.0, to half the country believes it. And so you've got half the country energized, like a standard color revolution type of model, like a Soros-funded color revolution. We have now seen that model literally taking place in the United States. So it's a civil war taking place within the establishment that is spilling over into the general population, into the, you know, resistance hashtags and so forth. And the only question, and I don't know the answer to this, I don't know if anyone does, is how far this will go. How far will this nascent Civil War develop. I don't know.
One of the things I tried to do when in the 90s was I built a software tool called Community Wizard, which would allow everyone in the country to look at the federal budget for their neighborhood. So you would be able to see the money going to the government. Right.
Yeah.
And in fact, I just published a new letter to my congresswoman that I wrote last year saying, look, you know, put all the data online for, you know, by county and by congressional district. So rather than us grappling with reengineering the federal budget, we just deal with how to optimize the pie in our place. Because that's where the solutions can get figured out. Because the general population needs to change their behavior in millions of ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the way to deal with it is what's called participatory budgeting, where everybody takes responsibility for something that they can walk around and see and understand. So you bring it back to down
sure.
to a very concrete level. But the challenge with that, back to you, Richard, is how do we get, you know, whether it's the color revolution, you know, either side of the equation, to understand the connection between the gridlock and facing the truth of where the money's really been going.
Right. Basically off-worlding the money, off-worlding the civilization.
Right.
Both physically and metaphorically.
Right.
Well, it seems, you know, we've got layer upon layer of deception that we are dealing with. And the older I've gotten, I'm sure the same for you, like the more we look at the layers of deception, the more awe-inspiring actually it becomes. You know, it's one thing when you look at, you know, kind of regular corruption, you know,
right.
financial theft, that's bad enough. But when you start getting into realities that are so far beyond what most of us are willing to consider, that is the UFO
right.
reality, or the truth behind 9/11, or any of these other things that are completely always dismissed by the official narratives. When I wrote AD After Disclosure, it really came home to me that what would a recognition of the UFO reality do to our society? And I concluded it would be probably the single most revolutionary development. And this is back in 2010. I was already at this conclusion. It would be the single most revolutionary development that I could personally imagine. It would transform every single thing about our society, and then I'm still unable to fathom all of the ramifications of ending UFO secrecy. And it became clear to me that's why the secrecy is in place, frankly. It's too big.
So
it will
here's
never
my
be
suggestion.
Relinquished without a fight.
Here's my suggestion, because I think there's an enormous opportunity in the gridlock that has started and is going to continue for us to be part of the dialogue. So, for example, when Charlie Schumer says basically the intelligence agencies run Washington, not the president, and the president has to
mm-hmm.
do what they want, you know,
yeah.
it brings up the governance question, who's really in charge here? And how come the intelligence agencies are more powerful than the president? And how did that happen? And why did that happen? And then you go from there. So I think there are a lot of opportunities for us to help shift the dialogue in an unbelievably positive direction, because I think there are solutions, but they start with transparency. But here's my suggestion. After having this conversation, I think we should do a part two. So I think you should digest. And we come back and say, okay, where in the budget politics dialogue, or the stupid idea of the Constitutional Convention dialogue, where do we, you know, pick up the thread and help people see the connection to this
right.
parallel universe?
Yeah, that's the great $64 trillion question. Does this happen from citizen-generated research, like what you and I are doing and a number of other people? Will this come from a hole punched into this situation by the president, by President Trump? Or is there some other way that it will happen? So I'm a great believer in citizen-initiated disclosure initiatives like this, because, frankly, the we're dealing with increasing levels of disempowerment at the hands of this, at the hands of this new, this neo-fascist totalitarian system that's just sucking the life out of us. Right. And the best way to defeat it is by re-empowering ourselves, it seems to me.
Right.
And the best way to do that is not to just have the president say, oh yeah, so here's the truth, people, but rather for us truly to fight for that truth and to win it back and to break open the narrative and to have a really messy situation for a period of time where we really fight it out in terms of what is the truth. And I think that's the only way. We have to clear the table. It's like having the most messy dining room table. You just take your arm and you just go, whoosh, you just throw everything off onto the floor and clear it off. And,
so what I tell everybody when they say to me, what do you think this is going to do to the stock market? And I said, look, until, you know, our choice is human or inhuman civilization. And frankly, all you care about is that it's human, and whatever you have to do to make it human, that's what you do. But unless the stock market can make friends with people, you know, and we can have a win-win between what I call the Popsicle Index and the Dow Jones Index, you don't really care what's going to have the stock market, because if you're chipped and mind-controlled, you know, it doesn't matter. So
I mean, really, it's like the mainstream media is not our friend. The political establishment is not our friend. Hollywood is not our friend. And the stock market is not our friend. That's really what we're kind of saying.
Well, here's the thing. I think there are a lot of... I could argue that the stock market, if you could create a system where you reoptimized, the stock market would be much better off, because
absolutely,
instead of popping 1%, it'd be 100%. So I think
it's working
there are
a true free market, a truly free market, free enterprise based system, which I don't think we have anything close to that. So I would agree with
but
that.
But I think there are a tremendous number of the people in the establishment and, you know, in business who would love to have a pathway to go there. They just don't know what to do. They're stuck. In other words, they're the prisoner of the system. So I don't see the establishment as being the bad guys, because if you look at the corruption, it's throughout the society. It's, you know, it's just as much in the general population. And if you look at the people who are absolutely dedicated to freedom... I mean, between my subscribers and clients, we've got people who read me who are homeless and read me from the library, and people who are worth, you know, more than $100 million, and they are all passionately committed to freedom, period, and that's first for all of them. You know, how do they find each other and be effective? They all feel like they're prisoners of the system.
Yeah,
so one more question before we leave the budget, and that is... What is going on in Antarctica?
Oh, yeah, this is becoming more and more interesting the more we look at it. The stories were leaking out back in, I think, November. It's funny, I was in Australia at the time that these stories were coming out. John Kerry was there, Buzz Aldrin was there. You really have to just say, you know, why the heck would these people be going to Antarctica at all? I mean, short answer, I don't know exactly. Long answer is I could speculate that there's a significant covert story here. And, you know, that story could have something to do with advanced technology, or it might not, but it might. And, I mean, the fact is,
it traces back to what happened to Byrd. It's very funny. I don't know if you ever heard Peter Beter, but Peter Beter swore that the Falklands War was the Brits having a war with the Nazi base down in Antarctica.
Well, there's a number of rumors about the Falklands War that I have also heard. I've heard what you're saying, and then another one with some really far-out scenarios, advanced tech.
Right.
Advanced, like, alien tech that the Brits had to get re-control over, and I have no way of confirming any of these. They just seem like really interesting stories more than anything else.
Well, the only thing I can say is if right in the middle of the final election, if you have the Secretary of the State of the United States down in Antarctica at that change of control moment.
Yeah, like why?
Why?
It does seem very bizarre.
Right. And so, you know, I used to always think they sent Prouty to Antarctica, New Zealand to get him out of town during the assassination. But now I'm beginning to wonder...
Oh, yeah, right. Anyway, there could be another agenda there.
Okay, so I want you to digest and think about this, because the budget process is going to be uniquely painful. One, the swamp is stuck and doesn't want to have to reinvent themselves. But two, the entire military-industrial complex is stuck with trying to manage two parallel universes and keep them secret and separate when we're talking in the trillions. And
we may want to consider just how radical Trump may be. I mean, how much of this is just talk and bluster, and how much of it is real? I think it's a fair question to be asking.
When
you look at the conventional, you know, conventionally speaking, he has said a number of things that are, in fact, quite radical. Wanting to be friendly with Russia, that's a radical statement, and it really flies in the face of the entire national security establishment. On the other hand, wanting to be enemies with Iran plays right into their hands. So they're, you know, and cozying up as much as Hillary Clinton would to Israel, same thing. So there's a lot of things where he seems quite radical and dangerous to the system, and other areas where not so much, where he seems like it's just business as usual. And so where he really stands here, I don't have a complete handle on it. But I do know this is a man who, unlike any president before him, maybe since Kennedy, clearly has an antagonistic attitude towards some of the establishment. And more than that, is obviously friendly towards some of what we would call alternative media. And I don't know of a single recent president who we can say that about. But Trump, yes. So he's looking from a different perspective from prior presidents, and he's not willing to hide that fact, at least.
Okay, so
let me
tell you one very important insight about Trump, which is important. So you know my concept of the popsicle index.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so the popsicle index is the percent of people in a place who think a child can leave the home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. Now, what you will discover when you dig into real estate is that one of the most important variables driving the value of real estate is the perceived safety of the real estate and the environment that the real estate is in.
Sure.
Okay. So if I own a building and suddenly the crime rate goes up in a way that is understood by everybody, the value of my building goes down.
Sure.
Okay. So if you're in the real estate business, and particularly the hotel business or the casino business, you are a nut about safety, both in the building and around the building. Because if it's not safe, your business could be destroyed. And, you know, and so you tend to get these Trump-like characters, you know, very much their ego is very personal to the building and the safety in and around the building.
Mm-hmm.
And you see increasing safety as a way of making you money. You get energy from increasing safety. Now, sometimes, at 30 years of making money in the real estate business, it's a very deep emotional tie. You are like a pigeon who's been trained. You know, it's a deep, ingrained habit.
So are you suggesting...
The relationship between...
Are you suggesting then that Trump will want to increase the popsicle index, as you put it? Will want to make that higher?
So as I watch Trump dealing with all sorts of different issues...
Right.
You know, I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, this guy thinks that the United States of America is his building.
I get it.
He's trying to make it safe. Now, he's not thinking of the popsicle index or whatever, but he's been trained to believe that the well-being of the general population increases the value of his building. And he's thinking, well, it's the same for America. How can we possibly make America be successful? You know, he's into optimization at a concrete level, whereas, you know, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, all these guys, they're optimizing invisible digital assets. He's optimizing the concrete. And in his brain, the health and well-being and safety of the people, whether they're his employees working for him or the whole thing. And he can't imagine a world where somebody wouldn't feel that way. It's a very feeling. He's a very empathetic. He's an empath.
That okay, is him, one of the most interesting insights
right.
to Trump that I have heard ever. And right. I think it sounds very powerful.
It is very powerful. And for him, it's a very important urge. It's got nothing to do with, you know, fascism and totalitarianism. What he knows is that the 325 million people here can't be safe unless you can have, you know, immigration laws that really are enforced, whatever the laws
right.
are.
Exactly.
You have to have boundaries. You know, there has to be some boundaries. You can't just have open everything. So it's not a fascist impulse. It's a real estate developer impulse.
Very, very interesting. Every way that you've explained that makes perfect sense to me.
Right.
I'm glad you did.
Right. So when it comes back to the budget, he's going to be looking at 325 million people and saying, how do I optimize well-being on that budget? And of course, he's going to run into this basic liquidator that says those people are expendable.
Yeah.
And that's
so
where the rubber's
going to
meet.
That develops. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. So, Richard, this has been a fabulous conversation. And
you know, we always go into directions that I could never predict, and this is one of them. And I so enjoy our conversations. That's really what these are. Like I don't know how the quality is with your other interviewees, but I always feel that we have really just what turns out to be a great conversation. I'm really glad that I was able to participate in that with you.
Well, when you're ready, I'd love to do part two, because I still think you know, I used to have a deputy that say, in the destruction of the old, let there be the creation of the new. And I really think that in the craziness of the budget process, there are going to be opportunities where all of us, you in your radio show or, you know, in your speeches or me on the Salieri Report, diving in together or separately and saying, now, you know, let's tie this back to this. And we're going to see opportunities to, you know, shift the whole conversation towards... because the natural impulse of most people in any walk of life, whether the general population or the establishment, is to want to make the pie bigger. So that's where we have to, you know, we have to find a way to dive in. It's like a surfboard. We have to dive in a surfboard and say, oh, well, now, see, here's why you ought to think about UFOs.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hopefully when we reconvene, I'll be rid of this cold. But I didn't sneeze and I didn't cough as I expected I might, so I'm happy. I think when we do part two, I'll be perfectly healthy again, which will be nice. I look forward to
it. Okay, well, Richard, thanks a lot. Have a great day, and we'll look forward to part two.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Catherine, and thanks to all of your listeners.
Bye.